I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Sadler, and Fields in the room. Representative Freer online. Representative Hall has a bill up in House Finance right now, so she'll join as soon as she's done with that. Thank you, Renzo Moises, for tech and teleconferencing support, and Andrew Magnuson as well. First on the agenda, House Bill 352, Healthcare Licensing Compacts. Courtney Owen, do you want to give a brief recap of this bill? Like a one-sentence recap would probably be sufficient.
Oh, yeah.
For the record, Courtney Owen, staff director at Fields. HB 352 would allow the state to join four compacts, or it would enact Alaskans' participation in four interstate medical licensure compacts, which include the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, the PA Licensure Compact, the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, and the EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact.
Great. Thank you. Available for questions, Sylvan Robb, Lori Wingheyer, Janet Orwig with SciPac, Marvo Ragunandan with the Alaska Psychological Association, and Brian Webb, the State Emergency Medical Services Training Coordinator. Do members have questions for any of these individuals before we turn to public testimony?
Yes, ma'am. Sir. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Go ahead, Rep. Sailor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I could go a long ways towards understanding the psychologist's compact, the SciPac and the e-passport. I would appreciate just a little more amplification as to what they are, what they allow, and the terminology. It's very cute. SciPac sounds cool. E-passport sounds cool, but I need to understand more what it is. They both are, please.
Great. Go ahead, Ms. Orwig, and maybe you could also update the committee quickly on what the psychologist talked about on maybe Friday, if I remember correctly.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So in order to practice under SciPac, you have to have an authorization to practice interjurisdictional telepsychology, or an APIT. And one component of that is the e-passport certificate. And what that does is it allows the psychologist has to meet the criteria that is required by that certificate. As you know, licensing requirements vary across the states. And so this levels that playing field out. All psychologists that practice under SciPac have to meet those requirements.
Yeah, she's a little loud.
Follow up.
Sorry.
Ms. Orwig. Yeah, I'm sorry. The e-certificate is, don't tell me what, please tell me what it is. Is it a certification, a license? Is it a piece of paper? What is an e-passport, please?
It is a certification. A psychologist gets a certificate, and based on meeting those requirements. That is a prerequisite to getting the authorization that the Compact Commission issues them, allowing them to practice under SciPac.
Okay. So it's a piece of paper they get, right?
It is a piece of paper. The commission, when they issue the authorization, they also get a digital badge, which allows anyone looking them up to be able to verify them through the verification directory that they are actually an official authorization holder practicing under SciPac.
And if I may just go back and forth, Ms. Chair. So there's a database someplace. And I'm sorry. And this is a asked the question of the staff right here before we went on the record. This is a government organization or entity. Is it a private entity? Is it a nonprofit? Help me understand the structure.
Okay. So the SciPac Commission is a quasi-governmental entity. It is an instrumentality of all of the states that have enacted the compact. It is considered a governmental entity. We do have a governmental website and email addresses. It is a representative from each of the states that have enacted the legislation, appoint their commissioner, and that sits at our commission. So we are a quasi-governmental agency. We are not a nonprofit or a membership organization.
Quasi-governmental, please help me understand, what does quasi-governmental mean in this case?
In this case, it means that there are representatives from each of the states. So it's not one governmental agency. It's not like the state of Alaska. It is made up of the 43 jurisdictions. So it's not a governmental agency of any state, and it's not a federal agency, but it's made up an instrumentality of all of the state governments.
Does it file a tax return, or does it I'm still trying to probe what actual legal existence it has.
It is. I don't have my W-9 up. We do not file a tax return, but we are considered a governmental entity under the under our W-9, but I don't have one of those pulled up right now to give you that exact code. I think it's under the Federal Tax Code 115 off the top of my head.
And I do not wish to be pedantic, but it is a governmental entity. Who deems it such?
The Constitution, which allows compacts to exist.
The U.S. Constitution?
Yes.
Allows compacts to, okay. Could you cite the section, please?
Not right this second. I can look it up and get it back to you, but yes, it does cite it in a section. I just don't have that pulled up right now.
And Ms. Orwig, I might jump in here, Representative Seiler, and we can circle to other committee members if there's another round of questions. Ms. Orwig, my understanding is Alaska Psychological Association met, and at this point is, I think, prepared to support SciPact as a compact, and Representative Colum got here at 325. Is that accurate, or should I turn to Marva Ragunandan?
I think asking Marva would be
okay.
Appropriate. Thank you.
Go ahead, Marva Ragunandan. Mr. Ragunandan, I think you're muted. Are you able to unmute?
Sorry about that. Just need to turn on my microphone. And for the record, my name is Marvin Ragunandan, or Marvo Ragunandan is my nickname. Last week, the Alaska Psychological Association, at their board meeting, voted to endorse and support SciPact, as well as HB 352.
Okay. Thank you for the update. I was hoping Ms. Wing-Heyer could come up alongside Ms. Owen. Ms. Wing-Heyer, I was hoping that you could give us some context following up on Representative Sadler's question. Is the state a participant in other compacts already, or are these the first compacts that we would be joining?
That's not a question, though.
Oh, I know. Some contextual information. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I am the healthcare liaison for the state of Alaska legislature. Through the chair to Representative Sadler's questions on compacts, the state is a member of dozens of compacts throughout most of the agencies or departments, if you will. The one I am most familiar with is, of course, is insurance from when I was the director, and perhaps Director Carpenter or Rob could speak further to compacts. But in that one, it was for life insurance products. And it was approved by the legislature, and again, using that the U.S. Constitution does allow states to enter compacts for trade and economic reasons. But there are literally dozens. I tried to get a list earlier in working with Courtney. I was not able to do so, but this would not be, these licensure compacts would certainly not be the first compacts that we've joined.
Okay. Do other members have questions? Representative Carey.
Thank you, through the chair. I think this question is going to be for Sylvan Robb, and I apologize if I've asked this before, but Ms. Robb, the division's fiscal note is a zero fiscal note, and I have two questions. One is, does CBPL currently do fingerprint-based background check work for other licensed professions in Alaska? And then I have a follow-up.
For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, there are a number of professions that require fingerprint-based background checks as part of the licensure process. So that is correct.
And a follow-up, are those performed by CBPL, like the actual fingerprinting process and staff work?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, so individuals submit fingerprint cards with their fingerprints on them that we then process and forward to the Department of Public Safety.
So just a quick follow-up, because I'm not super familiar with fingerprint-based background checks, but someone would go to a third party if they didn't already have that information, and then they would provide it to CBPL as part of their licensing process?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, if I'm understanding your question about, like, how you actually come to the point where you have a piece of paper with your fingerprints and ink on it. It is definitely recommended that people have their fingerprints taken by someone who is trained to do that. There's actually more to it than just sticking your fingers in ink and putting them on paper to get good fingerprints that are readable because they're digitized before they're sent on to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So they're, depending on what community you live in, there are different options for how to actually get a fingerprint card with your fingerprints on it.
Okay, one more follow-up on the same issue. So the Interstate Medical License Compact and it looks like also the SciPact are the two interjurisdictional compacts that require fingerprint-based background checks for these compact licenses. And I'm just trying to get a sense of, is that going to create a financial burden for either individuals currently practicing in these professions or for the department in terms of processing the licenses themselves?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I don't think, while we do charge a fee for professions that require fingerprints to cover the cost of processing, because when we enter the compact, then typically that means that individuals don't need to be licensed in as many states as they currently do, and so the net result for that individual would be a lower cost overall with the ability to practice in more states. And I apologize, Representative, I feel like it was a two-part question. And
yeah, I guess if you were practicing in Alaska currently, let's say with the Interstate Medical License Compact, or let's say you're practicing in Alaska currently, you don't have this compact license, it's not available to you currently. If we pass this legislation, someone wanting to obtain a compact license for the IMLC would have to, if they didn't already do it for another part of their job, obtain a fingerprint-based background check, submit it to the division, and have their compact license application processed. Is there any like foreseen barrier if we pass all compacts simultaneously that are in this bill, particularly with the two SciPact having a large number of people in the professions? Is there any perceived impact, any significant impact to the division relating to this requirement on the compact? In other words, I'm wondering if you need any funding to accomplish this additional requirement, because this is the part of the actual compact license that appears to be substantively different from maybe the current requirements for Alaska people that are practicing.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, that's a great question. No, as the fiscal note reflects, we don't anticipate that we would need additional staff to process the fingerprint cards related to joining the compacts. So for one thing, it's not we're not the ones who are actually we receive the fingerprint cards and then we pass them on to the Department of Public Safety, who then gets them to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And so we are kind of a pass-through in terms of that. So it's not doesn't require a great deal of processing on our end. And so we think we can absorb that work with existing staff. Additionally, once we join these compacts, then a number of people who are currently have an Alaska license will be able to practice in Alaska through the compact. And so that should result in a lessening of the number of documents and applicants that we have to process. And so a bit of a trade-off there in terms of time required by staff.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, do other members have questions? Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'd like to resume my questions of the previous line. So is the SciPact the same thing as the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact? Is it just different terminology, Ms. Orwig or Orwig?
Yes, it is the, thank you for the question. It is actually the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact. We just call it SciPact.
Yeah, I appreciate branding is sexy and cool, but it terminology counts. So, and what is the relationship between the SciPact or the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact? Right, start again. Is the e-passport the same thing as the Interjurisdictional Practice Certificate, the IPC?
No, it is not. The e-passport is a prerequisite for being able to do the telepsychology component under the compact, and the IPC, the Interjurisdictional Practice Certificate, is a prerequisite for being able to do the temporary authorization to practice.
Okay. or temporary. Okay.
Okay. Does anyone else have more questions right now on 352? This is not the last hearing on this bill, but
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. I'm looking at the Occupational Licensure Compact Comparison Chart updated February of 2026. And under the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, it says in the second box how it works, physicians register with IMLC and denote the states they want to receive a license, I suppose, in. Is there any limit? So physicians, if they qualify in one state, can they just check a box and get receive a license to practice in all 50 states in the multiple territories that are adherents to the compact?
Do you know the answer to that, Ms. Owen?
For the record, Courtney Owen. No, the each physician who wants to apply would have to apply for an individual license in an individual state. They wouldn't get, like, blanket authority.
Okay. I have a follow-up.
Sure.
Help me understand the language that says physicians, under the box, how it works for the IMLC. Physicians register with IMLC and denote the states they want to receive a license. Is that, how should I interpret that?
Go ahead, Ms. Owen.
I would like to invite Director Robb.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb, through the chair to Representative Sadler. So the IMLC, or the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, is the way that it operates is that a physician who is licensed in their primary state of residence then applies to receive essentially a letter indicating that they have met the requirements that the compact denotes. So regarding their education, their experience, background check, all of those things. And so then they use that letter to have an expedited license in the states where they are interested in practicing. So a physician who is licensed in another state would receive this confirmation of their credentials, if you want, that then comes to Alaska so that we don't have to obtain, or they don't have to have their medical school transcript sent to us. They don't have to provide proof that they have passed the examinations and such. So it speeds up licensure, but it does not.
Gotcha.
You have another question, Representative?
I do. Okay. So essentially this is a preparation, a pre-digestion of the application process. Does it streamline the process of sharing credential information? It's like if a standard, he checks these boxes, it gets you a little bit longer, the process. Does this make it easier for your division to operate?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, it will, again, it does speed the licensure for physicians so that they will be able to obtain licensure to practice in Alaska more quickly. And it does reduce the number of documents that we have coming in. So, again, instead of needing to see their exam scores, their transcripts, their proof of their clinical experience, we just have this letter from their home state saying that they have already checked all those things, and because it is in statute in every member state, we have all agreed what those things are, and so that they've met the requirements.
Does it save a lot of time? I mean, if you already understand the standards, how much of an advantage is this?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I think it will speed things up quite a lot because many of the items that are required, we require that they are sent from the third party. So you can't submit your transcripts to us. They need to come from the school directly. And obviously, neither the applicant nor the division has control over how quickly anyone is motivated to get those sent to us. And so in this way, we're not stuck waiting for third parties to submit information. So it will make physicians more quickly available to Alaskans.
Sure.
And in your experience with Ms. Winghire said we have state belongs to dozens of compacts. Do those applying for privileges to practice in other states generally like go to all states, you know, because you might travel to Delaware sometime and want to practice, or do they tend to be very selective?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, to some degree it depends on the way the compact is structured. what's required in order to practice in other states. Some compacts require that you apply for compact privileges with each state in which you're interested in practicing. Other compacts are structured with a multi-state license so that anyone who holds that multi-state license may practice in any of the member states. So, you know, it's hard to say. Certainly there are we see physician licenses for individuals who are licensed in almost every state. You know, people who have very specialized training who, you know, if you're a radiologist and you're reading, you know, specialized neurosurgical things, that might be experience that is demanded in all 50 states. And other times it's just, you know, depends on what works for the individual in their life. But certainly for people who, you know, live near a state line in other states, there may be a benefit to having this as well. If you want to practice on, you know, like a call a physician line, then it allows you to treat patients in member states because you need to be licensed in the state where the patient is.
Thank you. A different line of questioning, but I'll defer to anybody else who has questions.
Does anyone else have questions first? Okay, go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a general question that I've got. I understand the benefits of compacts in theory and so forth, but a question I've been asked by some folks is if you establish a compact, the analogy is you have a pipeline to allow people who practice in Alaska to also practice in other states. People that practice their professional specialty in other states can practice in Alaska. This is highlighted in the psychological, you know, telehealth, get you by the door kind of thing. But the question is there any estimation of whether we would gain more healthcare services or lose more? Pipelines go both ways. Highways go both ways. We assume that there's benefits to Alaska to having access to more people practicing here, but these compacts allow Alaskan practitioners to practice elsewhere. Anybody have any reassurance for me that we're not going to be losing healthcare services capacity in Alaska by adopting these compacts? I guess I would almost want to ask that of each of the professional groups that are represented in this omnibus compact bill.
Okay. Ms. Orwig, would you like to first speak to, do you anticipate that Alaska will lose psychologist capacity if we were to pass this bill?
Thank you, through the chair. So what we have seen is we do at an annual point ask our authorization holders at the point of renewal how many states they have been practicing into and in what states. So we do have a number for each of the states as to how many extra psychologists they are receiving during the year doing services. We also monitor the licensing numbers for each of the states to make sure, and every year we look to see if any have lost licenses since they've added on to SciPact. We have not seen that as a significant number of anyone losing licenses, and we can show the state-by-state analysis of how many psychologists have been in additional services into our states.
That's
okay.
Great.
Brian Webb, would you like to speak to whether you are concerned that EMS capacity would diminish in Alaska if we were to pass a compact bill?
Yes, thank you. Once more, for the record, this is Brian Webb, Alaska Department of Health, Office of Emergency Medical Services, answering the question for the chair. No, we don't anticipate any loss. And as I'd mentioned before in some of my prior testimony, we actually would require this to help us with our remote resource development and science projects, and then also our annual wildfire firefighting seasons to augment our force that we just don't have the people for. So we don't anticipate any loss.
Okay. Well, those are the professional groups that are online, Representative Sadler.
And a brief follow-up, and I'll let go. Mr. Webb, you said you don't anticipate any loss. Would you anticipate an increase in services? I guess that maybe goes without saying, but I like to say those things.
Well, yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yes, it would be an increase because, you know, as I testified before, like for the Shell oil offshore development, we required 70 paramedics within a month to come up. So yes, it would increase our workforce, but in many cases it would only be temporary.
Okay, great. And I'll hold that question for the next folks come up for the groups.
Representative Klum.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is for the sponsor or who could answer this. So I think the last time I had asked about the cost to the state, I mean, the fiscal notes are zero. But I know that when we've passed compacts before, there was a cost to the state. And I was going to ask about on page 14, line 9, under finance powers. It does say the Interstate Commission may levy on and collect an annual assessment from each member state to cover the cost of operations and activities of the Interstate Commission and its staff. So it does seem like the state of Alaska is going to have to be doling out some money. I'm not saying that that's not that we shouldn't join the compact, but I would like a little more transparency about how much these compacts are actually going to cost the state, not necessarily a department. I don't think I've ever passed a compact with no fees related to the commission. There's been zero fiscal notes, but this other area around how much the state needs to pay into these compacts, I don't know if you guys, if the sponsor knows or if that's information you could try to find out.
Ms. Robb, would you like to address that?
Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Colom. So most of the compacts do not have a fee that they charge to states for membership in that. And part of that is because the compacts are all governed by the member states. And so in order to impose that fee, each state would have to vote affirmatively to charge themselves some amount of money. And so there's a real incentive to keep the cost of operating the compact low. I believe the biggest fee for any of the compacts is $6,000 a year. So even then, it's not exorbitant, especially relative to the savings that we would see in terms of reduced need to process documentation.
Yeah, it doesn't mean, like I said, I support the compacts. I'd like to know how much each compact would be costing the state. I think that's a fair question. Maybe, you know, it's not that much, but I think we should know going into it how much.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I believe Deputy Director Saviors may be online.
She is. Go ahead, Ms. Saviors.
This is Glenn Saviors, Deputy Director for the Division of Corporations Business Professional Licensing. Through the Chair, may I ask clarification for the question? Is the question what the cost is to the state for each of the compacts in consideration in this bill?
Yes, per the line saying that the compact commissions may charge a fee.
Yes, correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So through the chair, right now the cost for the IMLC, so the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, is $0 to the state. The way that they fund the compact operations is through a cost that goes directly to the physicians. And so they pay a $700 compact cost, plus each state can add an additional cost for the privilege to practice in their state. So the PA licensure compact, a cost to the state has not yet been established because that compact is not yet in operation. And then the cost for the PSYPAC, or the psychology compact, is $10 per every authorization given to an applicant who lists Alaska as their home state, with $6,000 being the maximum that can be charged per calendar year.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think at this time, thank you to all the testifiers. We're going to take a brief at ease and transition to the next bill on the agenda today, HB 302 Travel Insurance. At ease. right. Back on the record. Next up on the agenda is House Bill 302, Travel Insurance. Thank you, Representative Hall and Keith Bruce, for being here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. For the record, my name is Carolyn Hall. I represent House District 16, which is West Anchorage, the neighborhoods of Turning and Spinard and Sand Lake. I am here with my staff, Keith Bruce, who is carrying the bill. Thank you very much to the committee for allowing us to be here to present House Bill 302, an act relating to travel insurance. Traveling in and out of Alaska is something Alaskans know not to take lightly. We live in a state of tremendous distances, remote destinations, and unpredictable weather. These factors and others expose travelers to a number of risks, from delays and lost luggage to physical injuries and worse. And each of these risks carries with it a significant financial burden. Losing one's luggage in the Anchorage airport could cost up to thousands of dollars, while a medical evacuation from remote Alaska could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Travel insurance exists to protect travelers from these sorts of financial burdens, and for states like Alaska, it's imperative that travelers have access to best insurance practices available. HB 302 provides those best practices. Based on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the National Conference of Insurance Legislators model legislation, HB 302 repeals existing Alaska travel insurance statutes that have not been updated in over 13 years. This bill replaces previous travel insurance statutes with a more comprehensive and nationally uniform travel insurance statute. My office and the office carrying the companion legislation in the Senate have worked closely with the Division of Insurance to ensure that HB 302 protects consumers while also making the process of regulating and providing insurance easier. The bill before you strikes a balance between the consumer, the insurance industry, and regulatory bodies by providing clear rules, standards, and definitions for travel insurance market. Some examples of what this means for consumers are clear disclosures before someone buys a policy, a prohibition on opt-out traps that trick people into paying for policy items they do not need, and upfront disclosures of pre-existing condition exclusions that could prevent a policy payout. For industry, HB 302 benefits include reducing the administrative burden created by duplicative filings, creates a streamlined licensing process, and it allows for greater distribution channels, all saving companies money and potentially reducing premium costs. And finally, for regulators in the Division of Insurance, this bill would create specific jurisdictions under Alaska's Unfair Trade Practices Act, details uniform definitions, and it specifies those definitions across all products. Additionally, it provides a trust and stress-tested framework that has been applied in 41 other states. The list is not extensive, but it does outline how HB 302 serves all stakeholders in Alaska's travel insurance market. Ultimately, the goal of this bill is that travel insurance providers will be more willing to enter Alaska's market, and those purchasing travel insurance will feel more comfortable doing so. In achieving this, HB 302 will help grow Alaska's thriving travel and tourism sector. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to turn it over to my staff, Keith Bruce, to walk through the sectional.
Sounds great.
Thank you to Co-Chair Fields and the committee members. For the record, my name is Keith Bruce, staff to Representative Hall. With permission of the chair, I will read the sectional analysis. Section 1 amends AS 219210P to provide definitions for blanket travel insurance, cancellation fee waiver, eligible group, group travel insurance, primary certificate holder, primary policy holder, resident, and travel assistance services. Section 2 amends AS 219210, Alaska's insurance tax statute, to add two new subsections. Section Q defines how travel insurance premiums will be taxed, and Section R requires travel insurers to document the state of residence or principal place of business of the policyholders or certificate holders for tax purposes. This section also directs travel insurers to report premiums for travel insurance and not travel assistance services or cancellation fee waivers. Section 3 amends AS 2127-150A1, describing insurance licensing. This section changes the statutory reference for who may be issued a travel limited producer license from the general requirements of AS 2127-150A to the new Section 2142-805, described later. Section 4 amends AS 2142 to create a new article, Article 4, Travel Insurance, comprised of the following new sections. Section 2142-800, Travel Insurance Classification and Filing. This section provides who can purchase travel insurance under B. For example, eligible groups under this section might be a college or school seeking a group policy for a field trip. This section also provides that travel insurance will be filed with the division as inland marine insurance under C, and that eligibility and underwriting standards for travel insurance must meet the same standards as the underwriting standards for wet marine and transportation lines of insurance under D. D and C essentially tell a division how to file travel insurance. Section 2142-805, travel insurance limited producers and travel retailers, details the requirements under which the Director of Insurance may issue a license to an individual or business entity to transact travel insurance. Section A under this section specifies under what requirements the Director may issue a travel insurance limited producer license to an individual or business entity, and that a travel insurance limited producer can sell, solicit, or negotiate travel insurance through a licensed insurer. Section B provides the requirements for when a travel retailer who is authorized to act on behalf of a travel insurance limited producer may offer travel insurance. Section C provides the activities a travel retailer's employee or authorized representative may not engage in unless they are also a travel insurance limited producer. Section D has transparency language and provides that the travel insurance product descriptions that must be provided to the consumer. Section E is similarly related to consumer transparency. This section details the administrative and compliance duties of a travel insurance limited producer when authorizing travel retailers to offer or disseminate travel insurance on their behalf. These compliance duties include maintaining a register of all travel retailers, certifying that travel retailers are compliant with federal law, requiring training of travel retail employees and authorized representatives, designating a compliance officer, and the payment of all applicable licensing fees. Section F provides that the parties responsible for an agency or travel insurance limited producer are fingerprinted in the same manner as insurance producers in their resident state. Section G clarifies that a travel insurance limited producer is liable for acts of a travel retailer acting on their behalf. Section H provides consumer protection language, specifying the minimum content requirements for written materials that a travel retailer must make available to prospective purchasers. Section I allows a travel retailer and their employees and authorized representatives whose insurance-related activity are limited to offering and disseminating travel insurance receive related compensation if they are included in the register of a travel insurance limited producer. Section J specifies that new Article 4 travel insurance, Sections 2142-800 to Sections 2142-825, apply to travel insurance, but not to cancellation fee waivers or travel assistance services except as expressly provided. Section K provides that any person licensed for a line of authority under AS 2127-115 may sell, solicit, or negotiate travel insurance. A property and casualty insurance producer is not required to be appointed to an insurer. Section 2142-810, Travel Protection Plans. Subsection A gives more transparency requirements. It requires that a travel protection plan can be offered for a single price if the travel protection plan clearly discloses to the consumer before purchase that the plan includes both travel insurance coverage and non-insurance services, such as travel assistance services and cancellation fee waivers, as applicable, and provides the consumer an opportunity to get additional information regarding each feature and the pricing of each feature. This section also provides that the fulfillment materials describe and delineate the features of the travel protection plan, including travel insurance disclosures and contact information for people providing travel assistance services and cancellation fee waivers. Section B details examples of the travel assistant services that may be provided under travel protection plans. This section provides that travel assistant services are not insurance and not related to insurance. Section 2142-815, sales practices outlining consumer protections and market rules, subsection A, provides that a person offering travel insurance to state residents is subject to AS 2136 trade practices and frauds, except as provided in section 2142.800 to sections 2142.825. This section also clarifies that section 2142.800 to section 2142.825 shall control in a conflict with other provisions in Title 21 relating to the sales and marketing of travel insurance and travel protection plans. Subsection B clarifies that offering a policy that could never result in payment of a claim is an unfair trade practice under AS 2136. Section C requires that all documents provided to consumers are consistent with the policy. Section D requires disclosure of pre-existing condition exclusions to the consumer before the time of purchase and in fulfillment materials. Section E requires, as soon as practicable, delivery of the policy materials and outlines cancellation and refund requirements. The section also defines delivery of fulfillment materials for travel protection plans. Section F specifies that materials presented to consumers must disclose if the coverage is primary or secondary to other coverage. Section G provides exception to unfair trade practice for travel insurance marketed directly to a consumer through the internet or aggregator websites when providing summaries or descriptions of a product. Section H prohibits use of opt-out plans that require a consumer to take affirmative action to deselect coverage. Section I specifies that marketing blanket insurance coverage as free is an unfair trade practice under AS 2136. Section J allows a consumer to secure alternate insurance coverage with proof of insurance required when a travel destination's jurisdiction requires that a consumer secure insurance. Section 2142.820, Travel Administrators, outlines those that may act or represent themselves to be an administrator and the activities they may engage in. A of this section details the licensing requirements for a person to act or represent itself as a travel administrator for travel insurance. B exempts administrators and their employees from adjuster license requirements for administering travel insurance. C specifies that the insurer is liable for the acts of the travel administrator administering travel insurance underwritten by the insurer and requires that the administrator maintain and send their available records to the director upon request. Section 2142.825, definitions. This provides definitions of the following terms in section 2142.800 to 2142.825, including blanket travel insurance, cancellation fee waivers, eligible groups, fulfillment materials, offering and disseminating, travel administrator, travel assistance services, travel insurance limited producer, travel protection plan, and travel retailer. Section 5 repeals current Alaska statutes on travel insurance, AS 2127-152, and Section 6 provides that the Act applies only to contracts or insurance policies delivered or renewed on or after the effective date of Sections 1 through 5. Thank you. That concludes my sectional analysis.
Very good. Let's turn to invited testimony, if that's okay with you. Duke DeHaas, thanks for being here. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, back on the record. Thank you, Duke DeHaas, for being here. And please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair Fields, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Duke DeHaas, Vice President, Deputy General Counsel for Allianz Partners USA, located in Richmond, Virginia. I'm also co-chair of the U.S. Travel Insurance Association Law and Regulation Committee. Thank you to Representative Hall, Mr. Bruce, for all of the work on this bill, HB 302, which we hope the committee would support. I'd like to give a brief overview, which I hope will be helpful. There was a lengthy and comprehensive summation of all the sections, so rather than spend a lot of time redoing both the excellent statement by Representative Hall and Mr. Bruce, I thought I'd run through a presentation that hopefully will make this meaningful and try to be as concise as possible. So with that, I want to start by just talking about what we're actually doing here and what we're creating, which is a comprehensive framework for travel insurance. So basically, travel insurance in Alaska currently is 1.5 pages, has a limited lines model, Alaska Statute 21.27.152. We're basically building on that, which is the original limited lines model that was a NCOIL model from 2010. Alaska passed it in 2013. This updates that with a much more comprehensive framework that's specifically dedicated to travel insurance. So as you can see from the slide, it includes definitions, provisions on premium taxation, and just to put everybody at ease, there's no additional revenue or any revenue being taken away. It's basically codifying the practice that currently exists in the marketplace as it regards taxation. Additionally, we're blowing out the licensing and registration provisions that are currently in Alaska law, adding additional consumer protections, including to those provisions, and providing for travel administrator accountability. Why is this a good idea for Alaska? We heard a little bit of this already during Representative Hall's excellent statement. You all travel, I think, perhaps have to, maybe more than anybody else in the country. And this is a product that is quintessential for those, or is essential for those who are traveling, and provides robust protections. So I'm going to get to the consumer protections now that this provides for Alaskan travelers. So, for example, when you go to Alaska Airlines website, currently it's our product that's in the booking path. As you're scrolling through purchasing your ticket, you have the opportunity to add on travel insurance to your purchase. If you make a decision right after you make the purchase that you know, I don't really want this after all, you have 10 or 15 days, depending on how the product is purchased, to give that up for nothing. Basically, it's a free refund for the 10 to 15 days, which is additional consumer protection being built into the model. Additionally, there's a total of 19 consumer protections built into the model. So some of the other ones are clear disclosures, so you know what you're getting into before you purchase. Another one that was mentioned was opt-out protections. So when you're in the booking path, you do have to make a decision on whether you want travel insurance. However, the box is not checked for you. That's an opt-out protection. That'll be enshrined in Alaska law. It's not currently there. It's generally not being done in the marketplace. This will make sure nobody can do it. For the regulators, and this is true around the country, will also be true for the division in Alaska, it provides a streamlined filing process. So this is a problem in a number of states where, not in Alaska, but in some states where industry had to split up their product because it contains both P&C benefits, trip cancellation, trip interruption, lost baggage, but also emergency medical benefits. And so some departments of insurance required the product to be filed both on the P&C side, as we call it, and the accident and health side. This will do away with that and make it one streamlined filing under the Inland Marine line. The division still has all the authority it needs under this model and under this legislation. They have additional enforcement authority that's made clear in the legislation. And then additionally, this provides uniform definitions, so regulators will be able to expect that the product that's being offered will have the same rules and regulations applying to it for everybody. Additionally, some benefits for the industry. Primarily what we seek is certainty and that the same rules of the road operate for everyone. And this will do that by enshrining these protections, prohibitions, and permitted practices into your law. Additionally, this will open up additional distribution channels. So one example that I've mentioned in some of my discussions with folks here is that if your child currently goes to the University of Montana and plays on a sports team, there is a group policy that can be offered in that state to cover the entire team when they're traveling. That product cannot be offered currently in Alaska because the eligible group is not permissible under Alaska law, but this will permit that specifically. And so it's another avenue and opportunity for the product to be made available and made easier for those in Alaska to purchase it. And it should bring in additional people into the marketplace, and so increased competition should also help Alaskans. So this is just a quick visual of where it is around the country. 41 states have now done this. We're working in another 6-7 currently, including Alaska this year. We're hoping to get it enacted everywhere in the near future. And then finally, just what is an additional reason to do it now? I just listed a few of the risks of not acting currently. Basically, and this was mentioned, I think, by Representative Hall during her remarks, Alaska's current framework was written for a different era of travel. 13 years since the passage of the limited lines model, the law needs updating, and travel insurance needs a comprehensive governing set of statutes, and this will do that. Without uniform definitions and filing requirements, there will be inconsistencies in protections for Alaska travelers. And as I mentioned earlier, the Alaska residents traveling with school groups, religious organizations, and tour operators may find themselves either having to buy separate coverage or without that coverage in the event of an emergency. And then finally, the additional consumer protections will help consumers and provide these additional disclosures and other permitted and prohibited practices that I mentioned. So finally, the model is tested around the country, and we believe it's ready for Alaska, and would ask you to consider being supportive of the bill. And then just, again, this is not reinvention, but modernization, and we'll put Alaska in line with the rest of the country. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know you all have lots of things on your plate, and I thank you so much for the opportunity, and it was great to be here. And I plan to come back later in the year with maybe less snow on the ground for a cruise. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mr. DeHaas. Ms. Carpenter, can you come up as well, just so both of you are available for questions? And you can just stay right there, Mr. DeHaas. And I have a couple questions if other members don't have questions first.
I have questions.
Go ahead, Rep. Lum.
I can wait.
Go ahead.
All right, thank you, Chair. So, Mr. DeHaas, so is travel insurance – I don't think there's anybody – well, maybe I should rephrase this. Is there anybody in Alaska, an Alaskan business, selling travel insurance? Or are all the travel insurance businesses outside of our state? They just sell in our state?
Through the Chair, Representative Colomb, if I'm saying your name right.
Mm-hmm. You did.
There should be travel agencies currently in Alaska offering travel insurance. This okay. will potentially make it easier for additional travel agencies to offer it. Mm-hmm. So often you can purchase it through cruise line, airline, right. somebody not located in Alaska necessarily. It'd be Alaska Airlines, though, here. But travel agencies around the country could be operating. It could be Expedia, a big tour operator, but it could also be a local travel agency located in Alaska.
Okay, follow-up?
Yeah.
So why I ask that is because I was looking at the map and how many states. So basically, if I'm a company in Lower 48 and I want to sell travel insurance in Alaska, they have to abide by our statutes or they have to do their statutes where the business is?
Through the Chair, Representative Colomb. So generally, the product, where the product is issued or delivered or sold is the laws that are going to govern. So if an Alaskan resident is purchasing insurance, they are going to have the protections of Alaska law.
Okay, that makes sense. I had another question, but
go
I can
ahead.
Wait for you. So maybe this is just kind of a observation. So the bill repeals all the old statutes. And I was looking at the differences, and the list of the travel insurance that they can give, like lost baggage, damage to a rental vehicle, sickness, that's all in the old statute. But I noticed they added emergency evacuation, repatriation of remains, and then this other thing. So these three, do you have any insight why those three things have been added? They weren't there before?
Through the Chair, Representative Colomb, great question, and causes me to go back through my history of sitting through 30 meetings at the NCOIL and NAIC. That's a cry for help, I guess, and sympathy. As we walk through every word of this model, which was deliberated at multiple meetings, consumer groups were represented, industry groups were represented, legislators were involved, and regulators were involved. So if you look at the original limited lines model, And what NCOIL did, I think, subject to check, all of these things were really included originally. It's just the NAIC saw fit to, they thought, you know, I think they may have been listed together as one, and so they thought we need to list these out separately. Oh. And just there's not a whole lot of addition there. It's not like the products weren't offering these things previously,
oh.
but it's now specifically putting them in the definition just to make it clear that those are also part of travel insurance. That's my understanding of and history of when I was part of it.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yep. I have a few questions. So, Mr. DeHaas, from your perspective, what is the benefit of codifying existing statute? Or, sorry, what is the benefit of codifying existing practices?
So, Mr. Chair, good question. The benefit from our perspective is everyone becomes subject to the same rules. And so I guess I'll use two examples. One is, and we work well with the division. Alaska's a great state to do business, and I won't pick on any other states by name. But commissioners or directors come and go. And their understanding of how the rules ought to work might change based on a whim. And not for this director, not for this state, but in other places, it helps to have the rules of the road written by the lawmakers so that the regulators then are subject to those rules and apply them evenly. Right. A second part of it is there are a number of insurtech companies, and we love insurtech at Allianz, but there are some insurtech companies and operators out there who do not get certificate of authority to operate. They do not get licensed to provide insurance. And if the rules are not on the books, it's just an understanding. Those folks can do what they want. This will require everyone to operate by the same rule book.
Yep. Looking forward is one of the benefits that any company that might enter Alaska would have to adhere to a baseline level of standards, and you wouldn't have a company that was financially unsustainable or engaging in some other riskier practice. Is that one of the primary benefits of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes, I agree with that. I believe that's right.
And Ms. Carpenter, what would you say in terms of what are the primary reasons that we would want to codify existing practices or put into statute some fairly detailed consumer protections?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, the Director of the Division of Insurance. I can speak, you know, broadly as you're considering this legislation. It is the national model that has been spoken about. So it has been adopted now by 41 states. So if you are considering adopting this, it is more comprehensive than our current statutes on the books. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest benefit is you have more consumer protections that are laid out, clear terms when somebody's buying insurance. So one, they can understand it. And two, they can have confidence if they need to file a claim, they're going to get a payout. And it gives the division clear rules to enforce. So when we have a consumer who comes and complains that something's not followed, we can track that down and make sure it was somebody who was licensed with us, that their product was filed and approved by us before they sell it. So it modernizes the statutes.
Okay. I had a question about how the bill is written. So Article 4 travel insurance has a section, travel insurance classification filing, and it says travel insurance may be provided under an individual policy or under a group or blanket policy, and then it lists 14 eligible groups. How are these a standard list of 14 groups, and how should we look at who should or should not be an eligible group? Either or both of y'all. Thanks.
Go ahead. Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. And I'm glad to see these in here because when I was prepping for this, I didn't see them and I panicked momentarily. So glad to see they're in here. So what these groups are from are basically borrowed from statutes around the country. So travel insurance is not individually underwritten. So when you purchase a travel insurance policy, they don't ask you a bunch of questions about your health or anything like that. It's basically take all comers, which means the product is underwritten on a group or product or channel basis. Basically, if you're purchasing a ticket from Juneau to San Diego and you're going to be there 3 days, most likely you're there for a weekend getaway or business travel. And so the way it's underwritten is pricing it based on that. And so these groups are recognized eligible groups under state laws around the country for typically life insurance or maybe even health insurance. So they're not just made up out of thin air. If you look at the first one, that's got a few more of the travel ones listed, B1. But basically, the other ones are borrowed from other states' laws. And these were debated at the national level. And the comprehensive list was included for the very reason that there's a discretionary catch-all one at the end. I think it maybe it's 13, if or I guess it's 14, that if someone has an additional eligible group, they put that in front of the division, and the division would have to decide if that's a legitimate group or not. The other ones being there are enumerated, so there's consistency across state laws, and you can write a policy that will cover a group with people in all 50 states.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions?
Chair, can you tell me what page that's on? What line?
The groups are on page 6, and it starts near the top.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Page 6 of the bill.
Oh, I see that.
Well, those are all the questions I have. Representative Hall, do you have further comments at this time? Okay. Should we set an amendment deadline for next week, or would committee members like a little more time to think about it? One more hearing before setting amendment deadline. Is that okay with you, Representative Hall? Okay. So maybe we could bring it back up Monday and see if we might have time to do that. Okay. So we can try and return to it Monday and see if people have further questions. And I guess that at ease. Back on the record in Labor Commerce, that completes our business at 4:24. We're adjourned.